You're listening to a News Report podcast from TheBody.com, the Internet's most comprehensive HIV/AIDS resource.
Welcome to TheBody.com. This is John reporting. I am also known to some of you as the blogger Fog City John. And today we are here to talk about gay men or men who have sex with men and unprotected anal sex, the practice colloquially referred to as barebacking. Now, we all know that unprotected anal sex poses a high risk for transmission of HIV, and yet despite widespread awareness of that risk, many men are still engaging in unprotected anal sex. And so today, I hope to explore a few aspects of this issue, including perhaps how widespread the practice is, what motivates men to engage in unprotected anal sex despite knowing the risk of HIV transmission, and in addition, finally, are there possible interventions or strategies that can help men adhere to safer sex practices? So, with that, I would like to introduce the guest panelists today. I am very, very pleased to have with us today from Berkeley, California, Walt Odets. Walt is a PhD in clinical psychology who has been practicing since 1987. He is also the author of numerous articles on the topic of HIV prevention and the book In the Shadow of the Epidemic, Being HIV Negative in the Age of AIDS. And with us from Atlanta, Georgia is Rashad Burgess. Rashad serves as the chief of the Capacity Building Branch, Division of HIV/AIDS at the Centers for Disease Control. Prior to joining the CDC, Rashad worked at the Chicago Department of Public Health Division of STD, HIV, AIDS, Public Policy, and Programs. And in New York, we have Jeff Parsons. Jeff is a professor of psychology at Hunter College at the City University of New York and co-director of the Center for HIV/AIDS Educational Studies and Training. He is also a member of the doctoral faculty in the Social Personality Subprogram and the director of the Health Psychology Concentration at the Graduate Center at City University of New York. Gentlemen, welcome to all of you. I'm very pleased to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay. Now, before we get to the main portion of our topic, I'd like to just ask you all briefly about the issue of language. I'm a lawyer by profession, so language is important to me. And I just wanted to ask all of you if there were what you would call appropriate ways to discuss this topic, appropriate terms that we should use. And I ask this because I did a recent post for this on this topic at The Body, and someone objected to the use of the term barebacking. So I'd like to ask you what you thought. How should we talk about this?
I'd like to respond to that. This is Walt. I think that what we're after here is helping people to think about behaviors that transmit HIV, not about specific sexual behaviors. And the term barebacking implies that any unprotected anal sex poses a risk for transmitting HIV. So that would be my objection to it. We're pathologizing behaviors rather than helping people think about when HIV might be transmitted. And that's one of those broad terms that I think encourages that confusion.
Rashad Burgess, any thoughts from you?
Well, I mean, I think, one, having clarity around what it is that we're talking about, one, is actually important. What I would say is that when you look at the science, I mean, on one hand, you have barebacking used very broadly to describe any unprotected anal intercourse, and usually it's used in the context of gay men. And then on the other side, you have barebacking used to re-identify those that identify themselves as folks that bareback or identify as a particular group of people who identify as a subculture of barebackers. So I would argue that we should probably be as broad as possible in the use of the language barebackers, and those being individuals who partake in unprotected anal intercourse, irrespective of whether or not they themselves identify as a barebacker.
And Jeff Parsons, any thoughts from you on this topic?
Yeah, I completely agree about the need to sort of keep
a barebacking identity separate from what we might construe as barebacking behavior or simply unprotected anal sex that poses a risk. I also think that intentionality gets pulled into this a lot, and that barebacking is often used as a term to refer to intentional unprotected anal sex, whereas, you know, unprotected sex that happens because the condom broke or the person had every intention of using a condom but somehow one was not used, that doesn't get sort of classified as barebacking. So I agree with Walt that in some respects there is a bit of pathologizing of it as a behavior, but I do think it's important to recognize that some gay men do identify themselves as barebackers and have sort of integrated that into a part of who they are and part of their community.
So, well, then I think what I'll try to do, maybe we should try to do in this discussion, is simply discuss this as unprotected anal sex, and we can talk about issues of intentionality as well, but I'm going to try, just for purposes of today, to stay away from the term barebacking. So with that understanding, I would like to get to what I think is probably the heart of the matter. And first of all, what do we know about how widespread the practice of unprotected anal sex is among men who have sex with men? Because I think that it seems to me a lot of HIV education seems to assume that kind of the default setting is that guys are having protected sex. And I'd like to ask you all, is that a reasonable assumption? Is that true? Or what do we know?
Walt, I think it's an erroneous assumption. I'd like to back up just for an instant if I could.
Sure.
The barebacking is a term that's widely used and recognized to identify high-risk sex. And if two men, neither has HIV, there is no risk of HIV transmission there. And I think I'm saying more succinctly what I said before. But certainly there's a tremendous amount of unprotected anal sex. And I do think that in this context that we have to make distinctions between negative men, positive men, knowledge of HIV status, and so on.
Well, let me just to go to that point. I guess that's an excellent distinction that I probably should have made myself. Because I think really what we're concerned with here is we're probably not concerned with, say, two HIV negative men in a relationship who have negotiated safety, if you will. I guess what we should probably be focusing on are men who either are negative or don't know their status and who are, despite the risk of HIV transmission, continuing to engage in unprotected anal sex with men whose status they may not know. Would that be fair?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. I mean, to be honest, I would be a little concerned about the first part of that, this notion that two HIV-negative men in a relationship with negotiated safety and sort of not having concerns. I mean, the epidemiological data is increasingly showing that a significant number of new infections are happening in the context of main partner relationships. And I think we sometimes make the mistake of assuming that when somebody is confident in their knowledge that they're actually HIV negative, that may not be the facts. And so I do think that we have to recognize that we can't just assume two people who believe themselves to be negative in a relationship that unprotected anal sex does not pose a risk.
Yes. So, but that goes to, I think, more the issue of whether or not, you know, they have their knowledge is accurate, their assumptions are accurate.
But this is Rashad. I mean, this is actually a very important issue, particularly in the context of gay men, where because of the background prevalence of HIV is respectively so high, so many gay men are unaware of their HIV status, even though there's a considerable frequency of testing. And so individuals will believe that they are HIV negative and have an operating assumption that they're negative and enter into relationships assuming that they're negative when they actually are not. And so one of the challenges we face in having this discussion is that when we talk about, you know, unprotected, and of course, and, you know, us having a different perspective for those that we believe to be negative, oftentimes that belief is not held true. And we're study after study where individuals who thought they were HIV negative, after being tested at the during the entry point into study, we found out that they actually weren't negative.
But having accurate information on that point is clearly quite difficult.
But back to my
original question, do we have some sense of what percentage of men do in fact adhere only to protected sex, and how many, some or all of the time, are having unprotected sex?
I don't think we have the definitive answer to the proportion of gay men. I mean, be clear, we're talking about gay men and sex with men who definitively only have unprotected anal intercourse, primarily have unprotected intercourse. I mean, you look at studies, I mean, it ranges significantly. I pulled some data up, and it ranges from 12 to about 46%. So it's a considerable range that it's specific to region of the country, city particularly, some differences in terms of race, ethnicity, differences in terms of age, differences in terms of HIV status. I mean, so I think that it's difficult to make a broad statement about the proportion of gay men that are partaking in unprotected anal intercourse, because it does vary significantly.
John?
Yes,
Walton. Just to go back to part of the original question, do you use the term negotiated safety? That is something that originated in Australia 15 years ago. And refers to two men within a relationship who have presumably determined HIV status and determined the kinds of sexual behaviors that would occur outside the relationship, if any, and have found a way to have unprotected sex. I agree with Richard. This is something that, and Jeff, that this is something that often has failed. But we have almost entirely in the United States failed in prevention efforts to educate men in that process. We simply pathologize the behavior and prohibit it in prevention, and don't discuss it, and don't help them to think about it, help them to understand how they can make that determination. I see this in psychotherapy patients all the time, very sophisticated people who really don't know how to go about that.
Well, what I'd like to ask you to do, Walt, if you could hold that thought for a little later on when we talk maybe about some interventions, because I think that's a really interesting and important issue that I would like to get there a little later.
Okay.
But I guess if we could, I'd like to move to what I think is the principal question, and that is why? Why in this era of widespread awareness of the risks of HIV, why are men still having unprotected anal sex? And I'd just like to hear from each of you on what your own knowledge and experience shows on that. And maybe we could start with you, Walt, as an individual psychotherapist. What have you found?
Well, it's a natural behavior, and it's of emotional significance. And I think gay men naturally engage in it. We have liked to feel that it was somehow dispensable, and it's really not emotionally. So again, we haven't helped men to think about what they're doing. And there are a very narrow range in which HIV is transmitted. But it has anal sex has the emotional input for gay men that vaginal intercourse has for heterosexuals. And it can't be dismissed. And we can't expect that that's going to be done all the time under any circumstances with a condom. It's compelling. It's emotionally compelling. And that would be the sort of crux of my answer to that.
Okay. Rashad Burgess.
I would actually agree with Walt and with respect to being emotionally compelling for gay men. I mean, my sex is not only physical act; it's very much a emotional act. It's an act that brings intimacy, love, pleasure, and so to not start with that understanding can lead you down the road of having significant misunderstandings of sex between gay men. But I would also add to that I think is really important is that, you know, given nearly 30 years into the epidemic and many of the benefits of treatment, the context of HIV is very different. And many communities of gay men do not have in their face the actual risk in that moment of making a sexual decision of HIV. Additionally, as we have people, gay men, because background prevalence of HIV is significantly high in a number, particularly with gay men of color, you really do have individuals at times making choices that, but yet not being fully informed. And so they perceive themselves as being at low risk for HIV while they're doing the things that we all would say are high risk, but yet them not having appreciation for the actual prevalence of disease, which results in them actually taking certain risks that they may not have taken if they had a full appreciation of the actual context.
So let me make sure I understand you. So you're saying that, for example, I know, Rashad, you've done a lot of work in the African-American community. Are you saying that people may have, men may make the assumption that their risk behavior is, their behavior is not risky, and it is, in fact, because of simply the prevalence of HIV within the community in which they exist?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
That's exactly it.
Jeff Parsons, what do you think, what has your work shown are the reasons that men say, why do men engage in this practice with knowledge of the risk?
I certainly agree with what's already been said. Sex without a condom feels better, and it does have a more emotional importance for men that I think it shouldn't be dismissed, but I think Walt's correct. It is too often dismissed, particularly in the majority of the prevention work that we do. And I certainly think that the majority of gay men out there are not trying to engage in behaviors that put them at high risk for HIV. So I think that what's also been said about the majority of gay men are engaging in behaviors that they think are harm-reducing. They think that they're serosorting by having unprotected sex with people that they either think or at least have been told are the same HIV status as them. And so men are doing behaviors to try to minimize the risk for the most part. But I think that there are also a couple of other factors that do come into play, and one of them has to do with substance abuse. And people who are active substance users who have binge episodes are simply not able to use all of their sort of cognitive and planning skills and abilities to either make or maintain the commitment to use a condom for anal sex. And the other has to do with sort of depression and other mental health issues, that you see men, gay men, who are experiencing significant levels of depression, turning to unprotected sex as a way to just try to feel a connection to another person. And it ties very much with what Walt was saying about the intimacy and the emotion aspect of unsafe sex. And so I think that the rates of depression among gay men and the rates of substance use, I think that both of these do play an important factor.
So this is Rashad. I think I want to add one piece of it, and I think it's important in terms of setting context, because, you know, on one hand, yes, we're talking about, you know, gay men having unprotected anal intercourse with knowledge of risk, but I think it's also really important to note that but across the board, whether or not if you're looking at our national behavioral surveillance or you're looking specifically at a number of cities and studies, gay men use condoms far more than heterosexuals pretty much across the board. And so I do think that is an important context to an important piece of information to put out there. We're talking about the risk of gay men.
Well, that is actually, I did not know that.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that my community is, you know, at least doing, you know, making an effort in this regard. And I guess one thing that brings up is, you know, can any of you comment on what it is specifically about the unprotected aspect of anal sex that is so crucial? Because, of course, you know, we're not talking about people not having anal sex at all. We're talking about guys using condoms when they do it. And can you address exactly what it is, what makes the difference? Obviously, unprotected anal sex feels better. But is there, what is the emotional aspect of that? Any ideas on that?
I'd like to comment on two aspects of that. One is that the presence of the condom, the minute the condom becomes part of the act, this is a reminder to both people that there's something dangerous associated with the act, that instead of making love, they could be killing each other. And that certainly is something that people want to avoid. So the association with the condom is certainly an issue. The other is that the exchange of body fluids, the thing that we talk about as the prohibited behavior, the exchange of body fluids is an act of intimacy, that it allows one man to have a part of another man inside of him. And that itself is compelling, and that obviously, that exchange of body fluid obviously requires unprotected sex. So I think those are two big issues. There are many others, of course.
What, for example, Walt, what other ones would you see beyond those two?
Well, there are several other things. The receptive partner often feels that he has to comply with the desires of the insertive partner. You know, part of allowing someone inside of you puts you in a passive or receptive position. And I think very often the receptive partner is compelled for those emotional reasons. I'm not simply talking about intimidation, but the part that this is emotionally part of the act. I think that the substance use that Jeff mentions is often an issue, that people's judgment changes. I think with alcohol, for example, we see a real narrowing of focus and attention. This then excludes all kinds of considerations like HIV. I think there are just a number of emotional issues. You're asking a very complex question about something that happens in private and that is driven by conscious and unconscious thoughts and feelings. So it's clearly very complicated.
Well, yeah, I realize it's a question that doesn't have a simple answer, and I just sort of hoping maybe we can, maybe you all could touch upon some of the things that, in your experience, you found as motivators. Burgess, you have?
You know, I would add two things that I've been coming from a little bit of a different angle than Walt. But I think when you look at the traumas that gay men often experience as children, as adolescents, as teenagers, and then as young adults, oftentimes it does lead to a yearning for intimacy that takes great precedence over the need to, for someone to prevent themselves of getting HIV. And so the, you know, the rejection of family members, getting thrown out of your home, needing a place to stay. I mean, so the levels of stigma that just exist in many parts of our society will result in individuals having certain emotional and emotional needs that that level of intimacy and intimacy with that level of risk will oftentimes fill for those individuals.
I mean, the one other thing I would add, I certainly agree with everything that's been said, is that there are individuals who like to take risks. There are individuals who, that's a part of who they are, that's a part of their personality. And although I don't believe that the majority of them actively are out to become infected, I do believe that a lot of them think that they can play the game of roulette and always keep winning.
Right.
These are often men who have had, you know, repeated episodes of unsafe sex and yet have repeatedly tested negative. And so they can develop this almost, you know, perception of invulnerability, that they just don't think that they're going to get it, or that the chance of them getting it is so small that it's simply acceptable to take risks on occasion.
And do you think that there is a, a sense in which men have sort of let their guard down in the age of effective treatment? Is that a factor that affects their decision making?
I mean, complacency is definitely playing a role here, in part because of the benefits of treatment. I mean, when you exist within many communities and you know, you and know of the people who are HIV positive that are living, you know, healthy, active lives, it does impact the perception people have of the disease and its impact.
Let me add something there, just to tag something on there, that there are people who consciously or unconsciously would like to acquire HIV, and I'm not talking about something pathological here. In a relationship where you have a so-called zero discordant couple, this is a big rift between people. This is a big separation. And there's only, in terms of HIV, one way to repair that rift. It's for the negative partner to contract HIV and to reconnect the relationship in that way. And I think that that's relatively common in relationships.
Yeah.
Zero discordant relationships are emotionally difficult very often.
And so, Walt, you're saying basically that in a zero-discordant relationship, acquiring HIV may be seen as an expression of intimacy.
Yes, and connection, and repair within the relationship. I've seen that in many couples.
Very interesting. I'd like to go back to something you said, Rashad, and because you mentioned childhood trauma as a factor in this, and I was wondering, sort of a bit more generally, is homophobia and the stigma that surrounds same-sex sexuality, is that something that plays a role in this? And if so, how?
I would say it absolutely does, particularly when you're looking at the risk-taking behaviors of individuals, looking at the risk-taking behaviors of young gay men. I mean, you have young gay men, many experience sexual molestation, many experience mistreatment by their peers or their family members, and so the way in which many find intimacy or find even security is through relationships through their partner relationships and or relationships even with older men young person doesn't have any other resources of their own. And so I think stigma, homophobia, has an enormous role, as well as the impact it has on their own self-esteem to even be willing to say, to negotiate safety.
Jack Carson? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think what Rashad said is a big one. That certain Jeff mentioned depression earlier on, but self-esteem, which is often connected with problems of depression, the self-esteem issue is a huge one. And, you know, adolescents, gay adolescents, even now, if this is lessened somewhat, even now would go through a feeling of being isolated, being alone, sometimes of being unique, and a distinct experience of being undesirable.
Yeah.
And what they find out as they get older is that their body is very desirable to other people. And that's a very powerful thing. And when someone is desiring you, it's a very difficult thing to kind of interrupt and start giving him instructions about how to desire you.
Mm-hmm.
And a condom would be one of those instructions. So I think that, in particularly in younger people, as Rashad said, that the self-esteem is a very, very important issue.
And on to follow up on that point, it does seem that we have a fairly high incidence of new infections, though, in men who are more in my age group, you know, in their 40s. What's behind that, do you think? Because obviously what you're talking about in terms of, you know, adolescence, you know, coming into adulthood, you know, those things are sort of, I would imagine, sort of in the past for men of my age. What do you think is behind the new infections we are seeing in men, say, in their 40s and in middle age?
Well, let me say, you know, one, you're absolutely right. I mean, you see across the board not only, you know, young gay men getting infected, but actually, you know, when you look at infections amongst men that are in their 40s and 50s, the far majority are amongst men who have sex with men almost across the board. There are a few exceptions in America, but very, very, very few. I mean, I think there are a whole host of factors, I mean, some of which we've already talked about, that for young gay men are applicable to older gay men. But one thing we've not talked about that I think I've seen experience many gay men in their 30s and 40s speaking about is issues around loneliness. And you know, I don't know if there's others that want to comment on that, but when many gay men wrestle with, you know, we said depression, but issues around just pure loneliness and what does it mean to be an aging gay man in a culture that I would in many ways really values youth, and if not in necessarily age, at least in appearance. And so I think that sometimes that does result in people taking risk that they maybe would not have taken when they were younger and they were very desirable but yet had high self-esteem and resources, and now that they've aged and are aging, you know, are willing to take certain risks because they are dealing with issues around loneliness and the need to be desired.
I agree with that, and what this is an inversion of the adolescent thing.
Right.
Where the adolescent discovers desirability, the older man discovers more desirability.
Well, and what can happen with both groups, the sort of young gay man who is desperate for that you know, boost in self-esteem to feel desired, perhaps has been, you know, the victim of discrimination or some kind of abuse, the HIV or possibility for HIV infection then just becomes really secondary. It doesn't get viewed as a major thing. I mean, these youth are likely to say, look, with everything else that I've been through, I can handle HIV. And we hear the same thing from older gay men who are seroconverting, where they say, you know, look, you can live 20, 30 years with HIV. I'm already in my 40s. You know, why isn't it okay for me to just kind of finally be able to relax about safer sex. And again, if it's tied to a particular contextual situation that is about them feeling desired, loved, wanted to alleviate perhaps some of that loneliness that they're experiencing, they're more likely to take risks.
There's also just some exhaustion over a lifetime with dealing with problems like this. And I think we do see in older men, you know, it's related to what Jeff and Rashad are saying, but it's a kind of throwing in the towel on protecting oneself. It becomes exhausting. 25 years, a quarter of a century, trying to avoid an infection is tiring.
Well, I can certainly confirm that in my own case. I think that was certainly a part of my own, one of the reasons I, you know, became infected. So I think that's a very, very important point.
And if I could just say one, I said this to a colleague of mine. There's not an expectation that non-gay people, heterosexuals, would use condoms for 70 years of their active sexual life, or 50 years, or how long ever long people are sexually active. And I think that part of what we, as a community of gay men and of HIV prevention providers, researchers, policy folks, is how do you deal with a population of people who have been working very diligently, I mean very, very diligently to prevent getting HIV, but they've been doing it for 30 years. And I think that the issue on exhaustion is very real, particularly for people who were in their, you know, teens or young adults in the late 70s, early 80s, and who did not get infected then.
Well, that is a good segue into the next segment that I hope we can talk about for a bit, and that is sort of the sort of interventions or solutions. And what I wanted to ask all of you is, you know, are there ways in which either U.S. psychologists, public health officials, HIV educators, you know, can intervene with men who have sex with men, and support them in adhering to safer sex practices? And, you know, earlier, Walter Detz, you talked about kind of teaching men how to talk about this issue. And I'd just like for each of you to address sort of, you know, what can we do? What have you seen that has worked? And, Walt, maybe we could start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to look just for a moment at the history of prevention. It initially was informational, and then it shifted to an instructive approach. And the instructive approach was essentially a condom every time for everything, all kinds of sex, not just anal sex. And that the informational thing is necessary. The prescriptive thing, I think, is wrong. It doesn't. It gives men impossible instructions, and it doesn't help men to think about things. GMHC, when Richard Elovich was there many years ago, did a campaign where they would show different kind of scenarios, they showed two guys sitting on the edge of the bed talking, And one would be saying to the other, you know, we've been having unprotected sex and we've never even talked about it. And then the tagline on the entire series of the campaign was, think about it, talk about it. So this is a way to use a cliche of empowering people to actually come up with their own approaches to prevention rather than expecting them to be compliant with simple instructions. The other thing, and I'm going back to what Rashad brought up earlier, is that the self-esteem of the community and the general mental health of the community is critical to prevention. Without that, it can't be done. People who are not happy kill themselves sometimes. And we've certainly seen that among gay men.
there have been programs. Gay City in Seattle was mm-hmm. a program which was about the general welfare of the community. This is something that is much better understood in the other English-speaking countries I'm familiar with, in England and Australia and Canada. But we haven't done that in this country. By and large, the federal government hasn't been willing to pay to help gay men feel good about themselves. If we look at some of the British prevention, it's extraordinary in its perception of that issue. So that has to be the foundation. The think about it, talk about it part then fits on top of that in a way that I think is much better. It's instructive work.
Rashad Burgess, I wanted to ask you. You were quoted in the January 2002 issue of POS magazine as saying, quote, "We have to think non-traditional, beyond handing people a condom." And I'd like you to elaborate on that. I know that was 8 years ago.
Yeah, that was 8 years ago.
But what are your thoughts today? What's non-traditional? I mean, obviously, you seem to be saying just handing people a condom and telling them to use it is not enough. What should we do?
Well, I mean, I think a couple of things. I think we really have to look at HIV prevention in a very holistic, comprehensive way. And I would actually very much start with where Walter is. We have to make sure that the communities of gay men feel good about themselves and believe that their lives are worth saving. We also have to recognize the fact that, you know, in many areas of gay men, nearly half the population is already HIV positive. And so we have to be willing to look at, you know, how treatment and the benefits of treatment can actually play a role in HIV prevention. And so, you know, there's discussions going on now around community viral load and actually what would it mean to actually really ensure entire communities are maximizing the benefits of treatment so that the overall viral load is reduced, if not undetectable. But I do think we're also going to have those individuals. We have to have programs that are for those individuals that are HIV negative, but are you risk takers? And I think it was Jeff that spoke earlier about the fact that there are some people who are just risk takers, and it's not because something bad happened to them. It's just that that's their makeup. And you know, we have behavioral interventions, and we diffuse effective behavioral interventions, and known as our Debbies, to help do some of that work, more intensive work that has been proven on behavioral science, using theories of behavioral science theories that really help move people to a place of utilizing condoms more, getting tested for HIV with greater frequency. As well as the last thing I would say is just general awareness. I mean, we know that if you know, you can exist in an entire gay environment and never hear about HIV or never see a condom or see any sort of discussion, people are going to think it's not as much of a problem as it was before. And so it is still about also raising awareness. And those of us who've been in the field a long time sometimes make incorrect assumptions that people are completely informed and aware. And what we have to remember is we have completely new generations of gay men that live in our communities that we have to re-engage in HIV prevention and in HIV prevention messages.
Jeff Parson?
Yeah, I think part of that sort of need to think outside the box goes directly to what Walt said, that the majority of our prevention programs are either outdated or so exclusively focused on condoms that it misses the broader needs of gay men in today's society. And it's frustrating that the funding that's available for prevention programs is really always sort of looking at, you know, what can you do specifically about the safer sex? And there's not as much funding available for programs that are designed to deal with some of the underlying issues like depression, loneliness, those kinds of things. And so I think that if we were able to package HIV education and risk reduction in the broader context of dealing with things that gay men actually care about and are interested in, that it could go a lot farther in having some positive effects. The other thing I'd like to add is that we do sometimes forget about the group of gay men who are out there, and it's a large group, who are very happy, very satisfied. They're not depressed. They're not lonely. They're not engaged in risk behaviors. They're not seroconverting. They're actually doing pretty well. And I think, and I can certainly say this as a researcher, that too often we don't get to focus on that group. We don't get to actually talk to them and research them and find out what are they doing to stay safe and to stay healthy and to stay well-adjusted. We tend to have all of our sort of emphasis and focus on those who are not doing so well. And so I think we miss a really big opportunity to find out what are the factors that are helping this large group of gay men stay perfectly safe throughout their lifespan.
Interesting. So we could actually learn from the gay men who are succeeding, as opposed to sort of focusing all our attention on those who are having trouble adhering to sort of protected sex.
They're obviously doing something right, and empirically we don't know what it is, because we've not really done the research to find out effectively sort of what are they doing and what are the facilitators to them being able to stay safe.
Well, gentlemen, we're coming towards the end of our time, and I would just at this point like to ask each of you if you have any final thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with on this topic. Anything we haven't gotten to, something you want to expand upon. Why don't we start with you, Walt?
Well, I just kind of sum up something that we've been talking about, and that is that, for example, on an issue like gay marriage, which has been so much in the news, every time a state passes a regulation against gay marriage, we're going to have more people infected with HIV. This goes back to the whole broad well-being of the community. That kind of stuff is hateful and destructive. And the association of HIV with black men involves some of the same kinds of issues. We can't expect to abuse people and then have them take care of themselves. But we have a very broad societal problem in this country. And the HIV epidemic is, in part, simply an expression of that. And I think that societal situation is something that has to change. It's inhumane and inexcusable that we're still talking about those kinds of issues.
Agreed. Rashad Burgess?
You know, I would actually start off really saying that it's one important that we as Americans recognize the value of gay men in all of our lives and the many facets of our lives, whether it be, you know, the business owners, whether it be, you know, folks' uncles or family members, types of family members, the partners that gay men have. Because it is a community that is imperative understands that their lives, and as a gay man, that our lives and my life is worth saving. It is important to recognize that HIV is still a real problem for gay men in the context that gay men are still getting infected. I mean, still represent significant portion of the epidemic. Over half, nearly two-thirds of the infections amongst men in America happen amongst men who have sex with men. And, you know, some populations of gay men, particularly African-American gay men, nearly half the population, based on some of our data, is HIV positive. And so it is really, really imperative that we as a community are having this type of discussion from the place that our lives are worth saving, but also it's based in reality, that HIV is a real issue, and that we have to be willing to deal with it and face it and wrestle with what does it mean to be working very diligently and hard at preventing HIV thing I would say is that we have to be willing to think about new strategies. You know, looking at structural interventions, looking at what does it mean to really be thinking about having gay men really utilizing the treatment to optimizing the benefits of treatment so that we can reduce viral load, which impacts transmissibility. And so this is really an important issue. We're not out of the woods in terms of HIV infections amongst gay men. And, you know, gay men that think they don't have to deal with this anymore are not well informed from where I sit.
Okay. Jeff Parsons.
I think one of our biggest challenges is re-engaging our communities to get re-involved in this issue again. In the 80s, you know, the gay bars had, you know, condoms everywhere. They had posters. They were doing, you know, eroticizing safer sex workshops in the back rooms. It was a real community-oriented effort to try to address the situation of HIV in the gay community. And I think part of the challenge to do that in 2010 is that the gay communities as they used to exist don't necessarily look the same. You've had such migration of gay men particularly into broader communities, into the suburbs, into young gay men don't necessarily just go to gay bars. They often go to mixed or straight bars with their straight friends, and there's not as much of the sense of community defined geographically. And so I think we really need to look towards building relationships with our allies, building relationships with broader communities to readdress and reengage about issues related to HIV in our communities.
We've had a pattern where every time we get a hopeful treatment, we abandon prevention. And we can see it very clear. There was a four-year cycle up through about 1990 where we had 4 years of prevention, 4 years of hopeful treatment that then was announced a failure and so on. And we have to find some way to integrate hope about treatment and support for positive men with prevention for negative men. And we've never been able to do that. In 1996, prevention completely collapsed. There was no interest in it at all. And we've been riding the protease inhibitors. They have, in fact, transformed the character of the epidemic. There is huge improvement over what we had before 96. But they have stifled prevention. Prevention in the context of successful treatment can feel like raising doubt about the efficacy of the treatment and pulling support away from men who are positive.
Mm.
That's the thing we've never been able to do. And we're still not doing it. We still don't know how to integrate that. When we do prevention, we're saying it's better to be uninfected. And that feels hurtful to positive men.
Well, I you know, as a positive man, I can tell you, Walt, it is better to be uninfected. And so,
but at an emotional level, it can be alarming and hurtful.
Yeah.
And feel abandoning. And we have to find some way to do both of those things.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I feel in a way that we have only scratched the surface of this topic, and it's a very, very important one. But again, I want to thank you for being here today, and thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. And for thebody.com, this is Fog City John signing off. Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a News Report podcast from thebody.com. Be sure to check in at thebody.com frequently for the latest news and information on HIV, including in-depth interviews with HIV-positive people, researchers, and healthcare professionals.